Louis XIV has often been taken as the paragon of modern monarchs, but the people of France rejoiced at his death. The complexity of contemporary states seems to break down any single mind that tries to master it. Hence, most governments have been oligarchies, ruled by a minority, chosen either by birth, as in aristocracies, or by a religious organization, as in theocracies, or by wealth, as in democracies. It is unnatural, as even Rousseau saw, for a majority to rule. For a majority can seldom be organized for united and specific action, and a minority can. If the majority of abilities is contained in a minority of men, minority government is as inevitable as the concentration of wealth. The majority can do no more than periodically throw out one minority and set up another. The aristocrat holds that political selection by birth is the sanest alternative to selection by money, or theology, or violence. Aristocracy withdraws a few men from their exhausting and coarsening strife of economic competition and trains them from birth, through example, surroundings, and minor office, for the tasks of government. These tasks require a special preparation that no ordinary family or background can provide. Aristocracy is not only a nursery of statesmanship, it is also a repository and a vehicle of culture, manners, standards, and tastes, and serves thereby as a stabilizing barrier to social fads, artistic crazes, or neurotically rapid changes in the moral code. See what has happened to morals, manners, style, and art since the French Revolution. Aristocracies have inspired, supported, and controlled art, but they have rarely produced it. The aristocrat looks upon artists as manual laborers. He prefers the art of life to the life of art, and would never think of reducing himself to the consuming toil that is usually the price of genius. He does not often produce literature, for he thinks of writing for publication as exhibitionism and salesmanship. The result has been, in modern aristocracies, a careless and dilettante hedonism, a lifelong holiday in which the privileges of place were enjoyed to the full, and the responsibilities were often ignored. Hence the decay of some aristocracies. Only three generations intervene between La Tête c'est moi and Après moi le déluge. So the services of aristocracy did not save it when it monopolized privilege and power too narrowly, when it oppressed the people with selfish and myopic exploitation, when it retarded the growth of the nation by a blind addiction to ancestral ways, when it consumed the men and resources of the state in the lordly sport of dynastic or territorial wars. Then the excluded banded together in wild revolt, the new rich combined with the poor against obstruction and stagnation. The guillotine cut off 1,000 noble heads, and democracy took its turn in the misgovernment of mankind. Does history justify revolutions? This is an old debate, well illustrated by Luther's bold break from the Catholic Church versus Erasmus's plea for patient and orderly reform, or by Charles James Fox's stand for the French Revolution versus Edmund Burke's defense of prescription and continuity. In some cases, outworn and inflexible institutions seem to require violent overthrow, as in Russia in 1917. But in most instances, the effects achieved by the revolution would apparently have come without it, through the gradual compulsion of economic developments. America would have become the dominant factor in the English-speaking world without any revolution. The French Revolution replaced the land-owning aristocracy with the money-controlling business class as the ruling power, but a similar result occurred in 19th-century England without bloodshed and without disturbing the public peace. To break sharply with the past is to court the madness that may follow the shock of sudden blows or mutilations. As the sanity of the individual lies in the continuity of his memories, so the sanity of a group lies in the continuity of its traditions. In either case, a break in the chain invites a neurotic reaction, as in the Paris massacres of September 1792. Since wealth is an order and procedure of production and exchange rather than an accumulation of mostly perishable goods, and is a trust, the credit system, in men and institutions rather than in the intrinsic value of paper money or checks, violent revolutions do not so much redistribute wealth as destroy it. There may be a redivision of the land, but the natural inequality of men soon recreates an inequality of possessions and privileges, and raises to power a new minority with essentially the same instincts as the old. The only real revolution is in the enlightenment of the mind and the improvement of character. The only real emancipation is individual, and the only real revolutionists are philosophers and saints. In strict usage of the term, democracy has existed only in modern times, for the most part since the French Revolution. As male adult suffrage in the United States, it began under Andrew Jackson. As adult suffrage, it began in our youth. In ancient Attica, out of a total population of 315,000 souls, 115,000 were slaves, and only 43,000 were citizens with the right to vote. Women, nearly all working men, nearly all shopkeepers and tradesmen, and all resident aliens were excluded from the franchise. The citizen minority was divided into two factions, the oligarchic, chiefly the landed aristocracy, and the upper bourgeoisie, and the democratic, small landowners and small businessmen, and citizens who had lapsed into wage labor but still retained the franchise. During the ascendancy of Pericles, 460 to 430 BC, the aristocracy prevailed, and Athens had her supreme age in literature, drama, and art. After his death and the disgrace of the aristocracy through the defeat of Athens in the Peloponnesian War, 431 to 404 BC, the demos, or lower class of citizens, rose to power, much to the disgust of Socrates and Plato. From Solon to the Roman conquest of Greece, 146 BC, the conflict of oligarchs and democrats was waged with books, plays, orations, votes, ostracism, assassination, and civil war. At Corcyra, now Corfu, in 427 BC, the ruling oligarchy assassinated 60 leaders of the popular party. The democrats overturned the oligarchs, tried 50 of them before a kind of committee of public safety, executed all 50, and starved hundreds of aristocratic prisoners to death. Thucydides' description reminds us of Paris in 1792-93, quote, "During 7 days, the Corcyrians were engaged in butchering those of their fellow citizens whom they regarded as their enemies. Death raged in every shape, and, as usually happens at such times, there was no length to which violence did not go. Sons were killed by their fathers, and suppliants were dragged from the altar or slain on it. Revolution thus ran its course from city to city, and the places where it arrived last from having heard what had been done before, carried to a still greater excess the atrocity of their reprisals." Corcyra gave the first example of these crimes, of the revenge exacted by the governed who had never experienced equitable treatment, or indeed aught but violence from their rulers, and of the savage and pitiless excesses into which men were hurried by their passions. Meanwhile, the moderate part of the citizens perished between the two warring groups. The whole Hellenic world was convulsed. End quote. In his Republic, Plato made his mouthpiece Socrates condemn the triumphant democracy of Athens as a chaos of class violence, cultural decadence, and moral degeneration. The democrats, quote, "contemptuously rejected temperance as unmanliness, insolence they term breeding, and anarchy, liberty, and waste, magnificence, and impudence, courage." The father gets accustomed to descend to the level of his sons and to fear them, and the son to be on a level with his father, having no shame or fear of his parents. The teacher fears and flatters his scholars, and the scholars despise their masters and tutors. The old do not like to have been thought morose and authoritative, and therefore they imitate the young. Nor must I forget to tell of the liberty and equality of the two sexes in relation to each other. The citizens chafe impatiently at the least touch of authority, and at length they cease to care even for the laws, written or unwritten. And this is the fair and glorious beginning out of which springs dictatorship, tyrannus. The excessive increase of anything causes a reaction in the opposite direction. Dictatorship naturally arises out of democracy, and the most aggravated form of tyranny and slavery out of the most extreme form of liberty. End quote. By the time of Plato's death, 347 BC, his hostile analysis of Athenian democracy was approaching apparent confirmation by history. Athens recovered wealth, but this was now commercial rather than landed wealth. Industrialists, merchants, and bankers were at the top of the reshuffled heap. The change produced a feverish struggle for money, a pleonexia, as the Greeks called it, an appetite for more and more. The nouveau riche, neo-Plutoi, built gaudy mansions, bedecked their women with costly robes and jewelry, spoiled them with dozens of servants, rivaled one another in the feasts with which they regaled their guests. The gap between the rich and the poor widened. Athens was divided, as Plato put it, into, quote, two cities, one the city of the poor, the other of the rich, the one at war with the other, end quote. The poor schemed to despoil the rich by legislation, taxation, and revolution. The rich organized themselves for protection against the poor. The members of some oligarchic organizations, says Aristotle, took a solemn oath, quote, I will be an adversary of the people, that is the commonality, and in the council I will do it all the evil that I can, end quote. The rich have become so unsocial, wrote Isocrates about 366 B.C., quote, that those who own property had rather throw their possessions into the sea than lend aid to the needy, while those who are in poorer circumstances would less gladly find a treasure than seize the possessions of the rich, end quote. The poorer citizens captured control of the assembly and began to vote the money of the rich into the coffers of the state for redistribution among the people through governmental enterprises and subsidies. The politicians strained their ingenuity to discover new sources of public revenue. In some cities, the decentralizing of wealth was more direct. The debtors in Mytilene massacred their creditors en masse. The Democrats of Argos fell upon the rich, killed hundreds of them, and confiscated their property. The moneyed families of otherwise hostile Greek states leagued themselves secretly for mutual aid against popular revolts. The middle classes, as well as the rich, began to distrust democracy as empowered envy, and the poor distrusted it as a sham equality of votes nullified by a gaping inequality of wealth. The rising bitterness of the class war left Greece internally as well as internationally divided when Philip of Macedon pounced down upon it in 338 B.C., and many rich Greeks welcomed his coming as preferable to revolution. Athenian democracy disappeared under Macedonian dictatorship. Plato's reduction of political evolution to a sequence of monarchy, aristocracy, democracy, and dictatorship found another illustration in the history of Rome. During the 3rd and 2nd centuries before Christ, a Roman oligarchy organized a foreign policy and a disciplined army and conquered and exploited the Mediterranean world. The wealth so won was absorbed by the patricians, and the commerce so developed raised to luxurious opulence the upper middle class. Conquered Greeks, Orientals, and Africans were brought to Italy to serve as slaves on the Latifunda. The native farmers, displaced from the soil, joined the restless, breeding proletariat in the cities to enjoy the monthly dole of grain that Caius Gracchus had secured for the poor in 123 B.C. Generals and proconsuls returned from the provinces loaded with spoils for themselves and the ruling class. Millionaires multiplied. Mobile money replaced land as the source or instrument of political power. Rival factions competed in the wholesale purchase of candidates and votes. In 53 BC, one group of voters received 10 million sesterces for its support. When money failed, murder was available. Citizens who had voted the wrong way were in some instances beaten close to death, and their houses were set on fire. Antiquity had never known so rich, so powerful, and so corrupt a government. The aristocrats engaged Pompey to maintain their ascendancy. The commoners cast in their lot with Caesar. Ordeal of battle replaced the auctioning of victory. Caesar won and established a popular dictatorship. Aristocrats killed him, but ended by accepting the dictatorship of his grandnephew and stepson, Augustus, 27 BC. Democracy ended. Monarchy was restored. The Platonic wheel had come full term. We may infer from these classic examples that ancient democracy, corroded with slavery, venality, and war, did not deserve the name, and offers no fair test of popular government. In America, democracy had a wider base. It began with the advantage of a British heritage. Anglo-Saxon law, which from Magna Carta onward had defended the citizens against the state, and Protestantism, which had opened the way to religious and mental liberty. The American Revolution was not only a revolt of colonials against a distant government, it was also an uprising of a native middle class against an imported aristocracy. The rebellion was eased and quickened by an abundance of free land and a minimum of legislation. Men who owned the soil they tilled and, within the limits of nature, controlled the conditions under which they lived, had an economic footing for political freedom. Their personality and character were rooted in the earth. It was such men who made Jefferson president. Jefferson, who was as skeptical as Voltaire and as revolutionary as Rousseau. A government that governed least was admirably suited to liberate those individualistic energies that transformed America from a wilderness to a material utopia, and from the child and ward to the rival and guardian of Western Europe. And while rural isolation enhanced the freedom of the individual, national isolation provided liberty and security within protective seas. These and 100 other conditions gave to America a democracy more basic and universal than history had ever seen. Many of these formative conditions have disappeared. Personal isolation is gone through the growth of cities. Personal independence is gone through the dependence of the worker upon tools and capital that he does not own, and upon conditions that he cannot control. War becomes more consuming, and the individual is helpless to understand its causes or to escape its effects. Free land is gone, though home ownership spreads with a minimum of land. The once self-employed shopkeeper is in the toils of the big distributor, and may echo Marx's complaint that everything is in chains. Economic freedom, even in the middle classes, becomes more and more exceptional, making political freedom a consolatory pretense. And all this has come about, not, as we thought in our hot youth, through the perversity of the rich, but through the impersonal fatality of economic development, and through the nature of man. Every advance in the complexity of the economy puts an added premium upon superior ability, and intensifies the concentration of wealth, responsibility, and political power. Democracy is the most difficult of all forms of government, since it requires the widest spread of intelligence, and we forgot to make ourselves intelligent when we made ourselves sovereign. Education is spread, but intelligence is perpetually retarded by the fertility of the simple. A cynic remarked that, quote, "you mustn't enthrone ignorance just because there is so much of it," end quote. However, ignorance is not long enthroned, for it lends itself to manipulation by the forces that mold public opinion. It may be true, as Lincoln supposed, that you can't fool all the people all the time, but you can fool enough of them to rule a large country. Is democracy responsible for the current debasement of art? The debasement, of course, is not unquestioned. It is a matter of subjective judgment. And those of us who shudder at its excesses, its meaningless blotches of color, its collages of debris, its babbles of cacophony, are doubtless imprisoned in our past and dulled to the courage of experiment. The producers of such nonsense are appealing not to the general public, which scorns them as lunatics, degenerates, or charlatans, but to gullible middle-class purchasers who are hypnotized by auctioneers and thrilled by the new, however deformed. Democracy is responsible for this collapse only in the sense that it has not been able to develop standards and tastes to replace those with which aristocracies once kept the imagination and individualism of artists within the bounds of intelligible communication. The illumination of life and the harmony of parts in a logical sequence and a coherent whole. If art now seems to lose itself in bizarreries, this is not only because it is vulgarized by mass suggestion or domination, but also because it has exhausted the possibilities of old schools and forms and flounders for a time in the search for new patterns and styles, new rules and disciplines. All deductions having been made, democracy has done less harm and more good than any other form of government. It gave to human existence a zest and camaraderie that outweighed its pitfalls and defects. It gave to thought and science and enterprise the freedom essential to their operation and growth. It broke down the walls of privilege and class. And in each generation it raised up ability from every rank and place. Under its stimulus, Athens and Rome became the most creative cities in history. And America, in 2 centuries, has provided abundance for an unprecedentedly large proportion of its population. Democracy has now dedicated itself resolutely to the spread and lengthening of education, and to the maintenance of public health. If equality of educational opportunity can be established, democracy will be real and justified. For this is the vital truth beneath its catchwords, that though men cannot be equal, their access to education and opportunity can be made more nearly equal. The rights of man are not the rights to office and power, but the rights of entry into every avenue that may nourish and test a man's fitness for office and power. A right is not a gift of God or nature, but a privilege which it is good for the group that the individual should have. In England and the United States, in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, in Switzerland and Canada, democracy is today sounder than ever before. It has defended itself with courage and energy against the assaults of foreign dictatorship, and has not yielded to dictatorship at home. But if war continues to absorb and dominate it, or if the itch to rule the world requires a large military establishment and appropriation, the freedoms of democracy may one by one succumb to the discipline of arms and strife. If race or class war divides us into hostile camps, changing political argument into blind hate, one side or the other may overturn the hustings with the rule of the sword. If our economy of freedom fails to distribute wealth as ably as it has created it, the road to dictatorship will be open to any man who can persuasively promise security to all. And a martial government, under whatever charming phrases, will engulf the democratic world. Chapter 11. History and War. War is one of the constants of history, and is not diminished with civilization or democracy. In the last 3,421 years of recorded history, only 268 have seen no war. We have acknowledged war as at present the ultimate form of competition and natural selection in the human species. Polemos pater panton, said Heraclitus. War, or competition, is the father of all things, the potent source of ideas, inventions, institutions, and states. Peace is an unstable equilibrium, which can be preserved only by acknowledged supremacy or equal power. The causes of war are the same as the causes of competition among individuals: acquisitiveness, pugnacity, and pride, the desire for food, land, materials, fuels, mastery. The state has our instincts without our restraints. The individual submits to restraints laid upon him by morals and laws, and agrees to replace combat with conference because the state guarantees him basic protection in his life, property, and legal rights. The state itself acknowledges no substantial restraints, either because it is strong enough to defy any interference with its will, or because there is no super-state to offer it basic protection, and no international law or moral code wielding effective force. In the individual, pride gives added vigor in the competitions of life. In the state, nationalism gives added force in diplomacy and war. When the states of Europe freed themselves from papal overlordship and protection, each state encouraged nationalism as a supplement to its army and navy. If it foresaw conflict with any particular country, it fomented in its people hatred of that country and formulated catchwords to bring that hatred to a lethal point. Meanwhile, it stressed its love of peace. This conscription of the soul to international phobia occurred only in the most elemental conflicts, and was seldom resorted to in Europe between the religious wars of the 16th century and the wars of the French Revolution. During that interval, the peoples of conflicting states were allowed to respect one another's achievements in civilization. Englishmen traveled safely in France, while France was at war with England. And the French and Frederick the Great continued to admire each other while they fought each other in the Seven Years' War. In the 17th and 18th centuries, war was a contest of aristocracies rather than of peoples. In the 20th century, the improvement of communication, transport, weapons, and means of indoctrination made war a struggle of peoples involving civilians as well as combatants, and winning victory through the wholesale destruction of property and life. One war can now destroy the labor of centuries in building cities, creating art, and developing habits of civilization. In apologetic consolation, war now promotes science and technology, whose deadly inventions, if they are not forgotten in universal destitution and barbarism, may later enlarge the material achievements of peace. In every century, the generals and the rulers, with rare exceptions like Ashoka and Augustus, have smiled at the philosopher's timid dislike of war. In the military interpretation of history, war is the final arbiter, and is accepted as natural and necessary by all but cowards and simpletons. What but the victory of Charles Martel at Tours, 732, kept France and Spain from becoming Mohammedan? What would have happened to our classic heritage if it had not been protected by arms against Mongol and Tartar invasions? We laugh at generals who die in bed, forgetting that they are more valuable alive than dead. But we build statues to them when they turn back a Hitler or a Genghis Khan. It is pitiful, says the general, that so many young men die in battle, but more of them die in automobile accidents than in war, and many of them riot and rot for lack of discipline. They need an outlet for their combativeness, their adventurousness, their weariness with prosaic routine. If they must die sooner or later, why not let them die for the country in the anesthesia of battle and the aura of glory? Even a philosopher, if he knows history, will admit that a long peace may fatally weaken the martial muscles of a nation. In the present inadequacy of international law and sentiment, a nation must be ready at any moment to defend itself, and when its essential interests are involved, it must be allowed to use any means it considers necessary to its survival. The Ten Commandments must be silent when self-preservation is at stake. It is clear, continues the general, that the United States must assume today the task that Great Britain performed so well in the 19th century, the protection of Western civilization from external danger. Communist governments armed with old birth rates and new weapons have repeatedly proclaimed their resolve to destroy the economy and independence of non-communist states. Young nations longing for an industrial revolution to give them economic wealth and military power are impressed by the rapid industrialization of Russia under governmental management. Western capitalism might be more productive in the end, but it seems slower in development. The new governors, eager to control the resources and manhood of their states, are a likely prey to communist propaganda, infiltration, and subversion. Unless this spreading process is halted, it is only a matter of time before nearly all Asia, Africa, and South America will be under communist leadership, and Australia, New Zealand, North America, and Western Europe will be surrounded by enemies on every side. Imagine the effect of such a condition upon Japan, the Philippines, and India, and upon the powerful Communist Party of Italy. Imagine the effect of a communist victory in Italy upon the communist movement in France. Great Britain, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, and West Germany would be left at the mercy of an overwhelmingly communist continent.